This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, we often talk about fundamentals when it comes to Tesla. We talk about the latest comments by its commander-in-chief and its founder, Elon Musk. Today, we wanted to really zero in on the stock. It's down about 45% from its all-time high back in November of 2021. This year alone, shares are down roughly 35%. Bloomberg Equity Markets reporter Esha Day writes about how Tesla's $350 billion wipeout in the first half opens a door for the brave. She joins us in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Store studio. She's there with Mike. All right. You got to be pretty brave, right?
How brave does one have to be to buy Tesla at these levels, Esha?
Yeah, and thanks for having me. Pretty brave, as Carol rightly mentioned. I mean, we have seen the stock fall 35% this year. That's like a $350 billion wipeout, right? And there's a lot of trouble brewing. We are seeing the company really struggling with supply chain shortages, raw material cost inflation. The bear market is really weighing on the valuation. The fear of a recession is really kind of weighing on the stock because, you know, cars at the end of the day are a consumer discretionary product. So, you know, if consumer is squeezed, it's definitely going to be a pressure on the demand for it. And then on top of it, we also have Musk and it's a deal and his plan to buy Twitter, which is really weighing on investor sentiment, who's worried that he's probably spreading himself a little too thin between too many high-profile projects. So, yeah, I mean, if you want to buy this dip, you'll have to be pretty brave.
Right. Tesla, SpaceX, Twitter. I imagine he wants to tweet from outer space someday. I think that's the ultimate goal in a Tesla car. But, Esha, so Tesla's famous for being sort of a very richly valued stock. I'm wondering what this wipeout in the share price this year has done to those valuations and how it sort of compares to the old legacy car makers like Ford and General Motors.
Well, you know, if you compare to the legacy car makers, it's still pretty steep, right? I mean, Tesla right now, despite all the wipeout, it's valued at about $700 billion. If you look at Ford and GM, that's there about around $45 billion each. So the main question, the main debate here really is, how should Tesla be valued, right? Should it be valued like a car maker? Should it be valued like a technology company? Or should it be like some sort of a mix, exotic mix of both valuations, and then you come up with $700 billion? When I speak to investors who are kind of looking at or focused at like a five-year time horizon for Tesla, they say that all the risks that I just talked about, the supply chain issues, the recession issues, you know, this uncertainty about Twitter. These are all real risks, but at the same time, they're also transitory. So if you look over the past 6 months, nothing fundamentally has really changed for them when they look at Tesla. The EV revolution, they believe, is still coming. Tesla still is a company that they think has the ability to innovate, and they are willing to pay this premium for Tesla.
Go ahead, Mike. No, please.
No, I was going to say, so the true believers are still on board, but I wonder, are their ranks thinning, do you think? Are some of your calls going unanswered when you're trying to find Tesla bulls? You know, he's out of the office right now.
Indeed. I mean, it definitely takes, I go back to that word, they're brave. It definitely takes a brave soul now to come out and really, raise your flag high and say that I'm still a Tesla bull. But still, I mean, there are people out there. And essentially, their main argument here is that fundamentally, we haven't seen a lot change over the past 6 months. So, you know, if this is like a 30% dip, 35% dip, go in and buy it.
You know, it is interesting. Like, I'm just pulling up the DES pages on Tesla and on General Motors. And when you look at, you know, the PE or the forward PE, it's just a completely different world. And you're right. It gets to what do we think of Tesla is, you know, is it a technology company that deserves those higher valuations? A growth company. I mean, if we believe the world is pivoting towards EVs and Tesla will continue to be a main player, then maybe they will grow in ultimately, into that valuation.
Indeed, yeah. And that's what I think the long-term investors are really betting on. As one of the investors I spoke to, he mentioned that, you know, for example, you have this Optimus robot thing. We haven't really seen much of it still, right? And he himself, being an ardent follower, is saying that, you know, there's probably like 1 in 10 a chance that it really works or becomes like a commercially viable technology. But if it does, then it would be massive. And that's what they're in for.
In for better or worse, I suppose. I've noticed Elon Musk hasn't tweeted in a while. I wonder if that's getting anyone spooked, or maybe it's a good thing for Tesla shareholders if he spends less time on Twitter. I don't know.
I think people generally agree that it's definitely good for volatility, at least for the stock, which definitely spooks some investors. It's not for everybody, and that's something even long-term investors.
You know, and it's interesting. It goes back to Mike, I think, of the discussion we had with Jess Minton. If I look at analysts, 25 buys, 12 holds, 11 sells. So there's still, Asha, there's still overwhelmingly the analyst community likes this name. It's not like they're bailing out. And just got about 20 seconds.
Yes, no, and that's absolutely right. Of course, there's, a larger conversation to be had about how Wall Street analysts generally have been slow this year in catching up with,
reality.
Recession. Yes, that's another word for it. Yes, absolutely. But no, it looks like, if you look at the average price target, which is around $900, that seems like Tesla is in for about 30% rise in the stock price from where it is currently over the next 12 months.
I would never count Elon out, at least not yet. Asha Day, equity markets reporter at Bloomberg News. Shares of Tesla, by the way, just down about 2% in today's trade. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Today, I don't know if you guys heard this, but from the NATO summit in Madrid, we did have President Biden saying he would support changing the Senate's filibuster rules to pass legislation ensuring privacy rights and access to abortion, calling the Supreme Court, quote, destabilizing for controversial decisions and including overturning Roe versus Wade. So we've been really reporting on how a lot of different communities are continuing to react to that decision. So now we want to get the medical community's perspective. For that, let's bring in Dr. Suzanne Bell, assistant professor in population, family, and reproductive health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, of course, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Suzanne joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Suzanne, great to have you here with Mike and myself. So let's get to it. Good to have you here. Is there a consensus in terms of the medical community when it comes to Roe versus Wade?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Roe v. Wade and the overturning of it specifically will undoubtedly negatively affect pregnant people's health through a number of mechanisms. I think the medical community and the public health community is really united in that front. I should clarify, I am not an OB-GYN. I am a doctor of demography in the School of Public Health. So just to be clear about that.
But demographics are important, right, in understanding the impact of something like
this. Absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of my work studies abortion, and specifically abortion safety in low-resource settings where it's legally restricted, which now is the case in many states here in the U.S. And there's going to be a number of mechanisms through which we see this decision negatively impacting people's health. First is that banning of restriction or restricting abortion will result in more people being forced to carry unwanted or unviable pregnancies to term, which increases health risk to the pregnant person, given that pregnancy has 14 times the risk of death than a safe abortion. And there was actually a study published last year that estimated a remarkable 21% increase in the number of pregnancy-related deaths if Roe fell and all abortions were denied, with a 33% increase among Black women, specifically given the higher rates of maternal mortality that they are exposed to in the U.S. The second mechanism is that there's going to be more later abortions, which, while still very safe, are associated with a higher risk of complications. A third is that more people are going to be self-managing their abortions when they are unable to find facility-based care and access to safe abortion. And so they'll turn to potentially unsafe and ineffective methods and may delay seeking care for complications given fears of legal repercussions. And then fourth is that there are a number of longer-term and broader health, safety, and financial impacts for those who are denied a wanted abortion. There's been a lot of great work from the Turnaway study. Folks at UCSF have detailed the negative impacts of being denied an abortion, and I can speak to a number of those findings.
But Doctor, one thing I'm wondering, as Carol pointed out, President Biden does want to try to end the filibuster so that Congress could sort of codify Roe versus Wade into law. But if that effort fails, I'm curious what you think about how well the U.S. healthcare system is sort of situated for a sudden influx of more lower income women carrying their babies to term. I mean, my guess is that we're not very well situated for that type of situation. What do you think about that, and what sort of would you advise that we need to do to the healthcare system to prepare for that sort of outcome?
Yeah, I mean, first I want to say that many people are going to seek abortions even if the state in which they reside no longer allows safe abortion. So the first way in which the healthcare system is going to try to adapt to this new reality is by meeting demand in states where abortion is still protected. And some work by the Guttmacher Institute has shown that they are anticipating huge 1,000-plus-fold percentage increases in states that are havens for abortion, like California, North Carolina, and Illinois in particular, where they're anticipating more than an 8,000% increase. So that's the first way in which our health system, I think, is going to try to adapt and meet demands under this new post-Roe world and try to get as many people seeking a wanted termination to be able to obtain those wanted services. I think, you know, in relation to those that are unable to seek and obtain an abortion, you're going to have more people continuing a pregnancy to term, more people exposed, as I mentioned, to the risks of pregnancy. And those are disproportionately going to be people of color, in particular Black people, who are three times more likely to have an abortion than white non-Hispanic people, as well as people below the poverty line. And so you're going to have this change in the composition of people who are pregnant in some of these settings where abortion is being restricted, populations that already are disadvantaged and have lower access to prenatal care and poor maternal health outcomes.
Suzanne,
that's going to be something to address.
We have less than a minute left, and one thing I wanted to get to, and this were in some notes that you shared with our producer, Paul, and obviously myself and Mike. Is there a possibility that if you live in a state where there is the ban, that you will be restricted from going to a state that doesn't have a ban? Is that even something we should be thinking about? And just got about 30 seconds.
I mean, I think it's something to be concerned about. I know there's states that are moving to try to restrict the mobility of their residents to obtain these services in neighboring states. I think the legality of that is going to ultimately go back to the courts and determining whether that's possible. I personally don't think it would be within the legal structure, and I also don't think that states will force their providers in settings where abortion is protected to report that sort of information.
Well, Suzanne, nice nice to get some time with you. Assistant Professor in Population, Family, and Reproductive Health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, along with Bloomberg's Mike Regan. And this is Bloomberg Radio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Second quarter, first half of the year, wrapping up with more superlatives. S&P poised for its worst first half since 1970. You're going to hear us say that a lot today. 10-year U.S. yields plunging to about 3%. We've actually seen them go below 3% from a decade high of nearly 3.5% earlier this month. The dollar's down, but still on pace for its best quarter since 2016. And the nearly 60% drawdown in Bitcoin since the end of March is the largest since the third quarter of 2011. Now, on the equity front, Bloomberg News equities reporter Jess Menton writing about how the bull market it never ended for analysts who are sticking to their very optimistic market calls. She's there with Mike in our Interactive Broker studio. Jess, so you're telling me that we're still seeing a lot of optimism when it comes to calls on specific names in the equity market?
There's quite a bit of optimism. And a lot of analysts on the sell side, they're still wedded to this idea that a lot of stocks could still rally at least 100%. The sell-off has left about 33 companies in the Russell 1000 with forecasts for rallies of 100% or more. In bear market casualties, if you're looking at, say, Peloton to Coinbase, they're forecast to double when you're looking at the consensus targets compiled by Bloomberg. And it's kind of a head scratcher for some people who might think, well, how could this be happening? But this isn't something that's new. This typically happens with the sell side, especially when you are in bear market environments. We did see it in March 2020. We saw it in 2008. In fact, in March 2020, there was nearly 300 companies that sat with predictions that they would double. And some of them, in fact, did because it was such a quick rebound. But in 2009, there were at least 100 companies that had those predictions that unfortunately many of them did not.
You know, Jess, it's a fascinating environment because I feel like investors everywhere are like, what is wrong with these analysts? And, right. and not just with price targets, but with earnings estimates too. Right. So I wonder, you know, what are some of the reasons people are saying for why analysts are reluctant to cut either, you know, say their price target or their earnings forecast?
Some of it has to do with career risks. And then another big factor for this year particularly is just the murky outlook of what's going to happen with the trajectory for earnings, because those are obviously still very elevated, but obviously the trajectory of the economy with the question of when we could potentially see a peak in inflation. And as far as career risks are concerned, a lot of times analysts are reluctant to be that first one to make a big change. And then especially if you end up being wrong, you don't want that to be a potential career risk. But then other analysts think that some of these stocks, especially when you're looking at the Fed's rate hiking cycle and what's happening with the economy, they may have gotten overcompensated. And some analysts...
It's not like, Mike, we're going to write that headline story that says, guess who got it wrong?
Right.
Well, I was going to say career risk. I think that's what Carol thinks of every time I fill in as co-host for her.
Oh, I love when you join.
What is going to happen here?
No. But it is a good point. And you're right, Jess. Like, I always find it interesting that when just somebody comes out, it was even like in the pandemic, like, or George Floyd, like nobody wanted to talk about it. And when that first CEO came out and talked, then everybody else would come out. Or when, you know, the first CEO came out and said, I have no visibility, then everybody came out. There is something about that, right, Mike? That happens.
Yeah, that behavioral psychology of it. And even some analysts have told me they thought that by this point it might be too late because they're waiting on a potential bottom. So if they change it, now they're saying, well, wait, this could be a potential buy. And they also were saying, well, it takes too much time for us to go through. And we want to see.
Wait, isn't that their job to go through?
Yes, exactly. And they're also saying that at this point, they already expect the second quarter to be not great. And so they're looking ahead. Okay, well, what does the next few quarters look at? But again, like to your point, Carol, that is your job to do that research, especially for people who are buying sell-side research.
You had one job. Well, Jess, I know you've written a lot about the notion of capitulation in the stock market and how to recognize it. When will investors say, enough is enough, I'm selling everything, get me out at any price? I wonder if maybe this a similar thing could happen with analysts. Do you think they could happen hand to hand? You know, what are people saying about that?
It seems like it's almost, when you're looking at the data, we'd have to be much closer to those recessionary type fears. And by that point, once they do start cutting them, then the markets could potentially rebound. So it is still, they're going to be late to the game. Eventually, if they do get to that point and people do start cutting those expectations, then investors could miss out on those opportunities to buy some of those stocks, and that research could be delayed.
So they're a contrarian indicator?
So as far as when it's specifically for analysts on the sell side, I mean, I think as far as contrarian indicators, a lot of people that I'm following, and Mike knows this too, as far as just looking at the technicals, and a lot of that just hasn't shown us just quite yet. We had seen a number of different head fakes like in March and in May, and then maybe even earlier this month, but still from like a breadth, momentum, volume perspective, have not seen that. And especially the leadership still being very defensive right now.
We'll find it if they're right, right? As earnings start to come out, and if we start to see those earnings estimates and forecasts by the C-suite come down. Right, Mike? Like that'll be a big deal.
And I always laugh because sometimes I feel like there's so many contrarians that it's sort of consensus to be the contrarian. And I don't know what that means necessarily.
All right. Good discussion. Jess Metten, equities reporter at Bloomberg in our Interactive Broker studio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Every time I read about this couple, I think, are they really for real? And apparently they are. And now this novelty rapper and her startup guy husband are facing trial. It all goes back to that $8 billion Bitfinex hack back in August of 2016. It's another great tale in this week's new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, that annual double issue dedicated to tales of robbery, scams, and snitches known as the heist issue. So let's get to it. Joining us is Bloomberg Business Week editor Jill Weber, with us on the Access line in Brooklyn, and Bloomberg News Financial Investigations reporter Zeke Fox, joining us also from Brooklyn. I got to say, we were reading out lines from this story, Joel, in the newsroom today.
Yeah, you're gonna laugh because there's some great ones, and some of them come from Zeke, and some of them are just from the story itself, because this was bonkers. Kind of felt like it broke the internet when the story initially broke earlier this year. And we asked Zeke to kind of just like sink into it. And as Zeke does, he came back with like the most Zeke possible version of a heist story. And what was incredible about this is that it might actually be the biggest heist of all time, right? Zeke, how does that happen?
The next was one of the biggest crypto exchanges in the world in 2016. But like a lot of exchanges, it had what appears to be very poor security. And somebody got into the exchange and you stole the passwords to their bitcoins and transferred out more than half the bitcoins, more than 100,000 bitcoins. And for years, it was a mystery what happened. And the value of those bitcoins rose and rose until at their peak, the missing bitcoins were worth more than $8 billion.
Zeke, I wanted to ask you about the two main characters in this story, Heather Morgan, a.k.a. Razzle Khan, and her husband. You describe what I consider some major crimes against music on her part and her rap music.
Among other crimes.
Just awful, awful rap music is her claim to fame. But I don't get the opinion that she was a criminal going into this. She just sort of stumbled into this heist. Walk us through what we know about how these two got involved in this caper.
Yeah, I mean, that was what was so crazy, is that in February, out of nowhere, the Department of Justice announced that they'd recovered most of the Bitcoins and arrested two people for money laundering. It was this couple, Heather and Ilya. And Heather, as I said in the story, she's got this rap persona. And I was just, it struck me. I was like, could the Master Thief really be someone who tried to rhyme Razzle Khan's the name with that hot grandma you really want to bang?
That was like, the one I read in the newsroom.
Yeah, I mean, it was just, it seems so unlikely. It's like something you wouldn't believe if someone made it up. And yeah, she has like a very standard, or not very standard, but her background, nothing about her background suggests that she would get involved in something like this. But the fact is, when the authorities raided their apartment down in the financial district, what they found on the husband's cloud accounts was an encrypted file that contained the passwords to all these stolen Bitcoins. And like in Bitcoin, you don't let anyone, whoever controls these private keys, these passwords, controls the coin. So the fact that he's in possession of all the stolen funds is like a strong suggestion that he may have been the one who took them. And the authorities also have evidence that Morgan participated in efforts to move this money and to conceal its origins. So that's why she got arrested too. But yeah, it really is mysterious how if these two are in fact the hackers, how they got into it,
right?
Or why they were trying to attract so much attention after they had pulled off like this crazy crime.
So yeah, break that down for us, because obviously this hack happened a while ago, and then it was sort of this big mystery. And what was the thing that triggered authorities becoming increasingly interested?
So with Bitcoin, it exists as like an entry on a distributed database. So anyone could look up the addresses where the hackers sent the funds. Like this was public, and they could see that the Bitcoins were in like these numbered addresses. But there's no association with any person. So the problem was that the reputable Bitcoin companies don't want to touch Bitcoins that they know come from a crime, like a hack. So the hackers needed to find some way to move these Bitcoins to someone who didn't care. And they found one place, which was called AlphaBay, which was a place essentially eBay for like drugs and guns on the dark web. And the thinking was that you send the Bitcoins to AlphaBay, and then inside AlphaBay, all the funds are mixed up. So then when you withdraw the Bitcoins from AlphaBay to a new address, no one will know that the new address is associated with the hack. The problem was that the authorities, in particular the cybercrime unit within the IRS, was on like this crazy streak of cracking crypto crimes. And one of the places they went after was AlphaBay. And after like this raid with the Royal Thai Police in Thailand, they were able to get AlphaBay's computers, and that meant they had all of AlphaBay's internal records, and they could connect transfers to AlphaBay with transfers out of AlphaBay. So transfers that the hackers thought were safe were now able to be figured out. But the fact is that there was, this was such a trove of data that the authorities were bringing all sorts of cases related to this. And it took them a few years before they realized what they had and were able to gather enough evidence to search Heather and Ilya's apartment.
And Zeke, quickly, where do things stand now? And if there's any leftover Bitcoin hiding somewhere that these two might be able to eventually get to, where might that be?
And just 40 seconds, Zeke.
So Ilya is in prison awaiting trial. Heather is out on bail. And there's evidence that they sent some, or whoever had these Bitcoins sent them to another darknet market in Russia called Hydra. And on Hydra, you could pay someone in Bitcoin and have them bury rubles underground for you. And then you could go dig them up later. So You never know. They took quite a lot of money to Hydra. There could be some bundles of rubles sitting somewhere waiting for Heather and Ilya to come dig them up.
I feel like there'll be another Zeke Fox story on this, no doubt about it. But I love it. I love it. Joel Weber, thank you so much. Editor of Bloomberg Business Week, joining us on the Access Line from Brooklyn. Zeke Fox wrote this story, financial investigations reporter at Bloomberg News on the phone from Brooklyn. It is the annual heist issue. It's a double issue. The stories are just, it was the first story I read this morning with my morning coffee. So I highly recommend that you check them out.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Yes, indeed. Just about 10 and a half minutes, and then we will be wrapping up the second quarter as well as the first half of 2022. Bouncing around in today's trade, we're definitely off our lows of the session, but also off our highs. But we've seen pretty much, I think, red for almost all of the day here, or most of the day. So let's get to it, and let's get to our Drive to the Close guest. Brent Schuette is back with us, Chief Investment Officer at Northwestern Mutual Wealth Management, roughly $237 billion in assets under management. And he joins us on the phone in Milwaukee. Hey, Brent, it's good to have you here with Mike Regan and myself. We've got a story on the Bloomberg today. Mike and I just talked about it, about Citi's family office clients, those with over $1 billion in assets. They're boosting their investments amid the market volatility, all asset classes. What big positions are your clients taking amid the big market moves that we've been seeing?
Well, I don't know if we've necessarily changed our big positions. We have owned commodities and gold and things that go up when inflation goes up, and that's been a hedge that we've had in our portfolios for some time. I guess the thing that I would advise individual investors not to do is sell based upon what has happened, because I do think the second half will be much better than the first half. Look, the biggest question out there is
why do you think it's going to be better in the second half?
Because I think the big fear out there right now, so we do swing back and forth between recession and inflation fears. I think the big fear that's out there is that this is somehow like the 1970s. In that even though demand is going to fall, which undoubtedly it's going to fall, the big fear is that inflation won't fall with it. And I don't think that's the case. I think you're already starting to see signs of inflation pulling back. The market is already showing you that they believe it's going to pull back. And I think that backdrop will lead to a stronger second half for stocks, because we won't have to worry about the Fed continuing to hike us so far into a recession. We certainly could have a recession, but it would be very, very mild. And I think the market's already discounted that.
You know, Brent, inflation can be such a tricky thing to forecast and predict. I'm wondering what sort of signals you're looking at. I mean, obviously, we've had commodities from the index level come off their highs. I was talking about break-even inflation rates in the bond market. They're also suggesting, at least, you know, for the next 5 years or so, expectations are coming down. How are you going about wrapping your head around what to expect with inflation for the rest of the year?
Yeah, so I do think you're seeing a few reasons why it should fall. First of all, you're seeing that shift from goods spending to service sector spending at the same time that you've rebuilt goods inventories. And so if you look at the components of the PCE, the really, really odd parts are the goods parts of the equation. And those are going to start pulling back
because you've had inventories rebuilt and the consumer isn't going to continue to spend in the same way they did on goods because they pulled that forward during COVID. That's point number one. Point number two, I do think the demand destruction that is occurring right now, you mentioned some of them, is causing commodity prices to roll over, which will actually also have a positive impact on inflation. And so I look at container rates. Everybody was talking about those earlier this year. We kind of forgot about those things. They're 32% off their highs. The Baltic Dry Index is 62% off its highs. Lumber is 57% off its highs. Commodities in general are 13% off its highs. Oil has fallen 15% off its highs. And you mentioned market expectations. And so I think when you combine those two things with inflation expectations, which is where the Fed got worried, the Fed was worried that the temporary or transitory or whatever the word may be, the supply and demand imbalances, they were worried that would become permanent because people started believing it was permanent.
Right.
And that's why they went faster. And that's been tamped down quite a bit, too. And so I think you're going to see that come down. And I think you're going to have a better second half because of that.
You know, Brent, it's funny. It seems like almost everyone I talk to or everyone I read about from the buy side thinks that analysts are just out to lunch these days and that those earnings forecasts, you know, double digit earnings forecasts for the rest of the year have only one way to go. I wonder how, you know, are you in that camp that thinks, you know, analysts are sort of late to pick up on the damage being done to the economy? And, you know, the other flip side of the coin is, well, companies tend to almost always beat these expectations. So where do you see that sort of equilibrium between what analysts expect, what the market expects them to do with estimates and where we'll end up?
Yeah, and this is where I don't even know if I have to forecast, Matt. I think they will come down. But this is where we've been talking about for the prior 6, 9, 12 months to be in things that are cheaper and where expectations aren't as stretched. And
right.
So if I look at the NASDAQ, I believe NASDAQ earnings are expected to be up 60% year over year for 2022. I think the chances of that happening are probably somewhere around at zero. But if you look at things like U.S. small caps, and I talk about the S&P 600, they trade at 11 times their 2022 expected earnings. Even if I cut those 20, 30%, they are still cheap on an absolute basis compared to their history and on a relative basis to other parts of the market. And that's where I would continue to focus my capital on things that are cheap. And I'm going to take you way back in time and have a margin of safety versus decreased expectations.
What's the biggest risk for investors right now?
Panicking. I guess you're talking about individual investors. I mean, we talk about this every single time that you shouldn't sell when others do. And yet every single time investors find a new reason why they believe it's different. And I still haven't found one that's actually different in my time of doing this, which is now 27 years. Look, I think the big risk still is certainly what's happening in Russia and Ukraine and energy prices and how long those stay where they're at. And are we, you know, typically, are we going to be in more of an energy shock for some period of time? That certainly has had a staying power on inflation so far. But I think you're starting to see everything else kind of depreciate around it, which I think is a good news for inflation. But certainly that is still one of the bigger risks that's out there. I think, you know, we've seen a lot of wealth destroyed. I think in the crypto area, we've seen quite a bit. That certainly is some sort of a risk, too. But I think that's actually helping to bring inflation right now, which actually has a silver lining to it.
Hey, Brett, how about over in the bond market? You know, we have seen 10-year yields kind of come back down below 3% today. But boy, if we went back in time a few years and I told you you could get almost 3% on a 10-year treasury, I think a lot of people would have, you know, jumped out of their seat for that. Is there value there now or what? Are you more excited about stocks as far as a 60-40 type of split? Would you be going 70-30 or 50-50? You know, what's the sort of relative attractiveness between the two?
Well, I think the good news now is that bonds are more of a hedge against portfolio deterioration than they were, 6-12 months ago when they yielded basically nothing. And you've had that rate shock that hasn't happened. You know, we've taken the 10-year treasury from what 50 basis points of a year or so ago, or maybe a little bit more than that, 150 at the end of the year up to 3%. So I think they are a hedge against that. I'm more excited on the equity side, but I think bonds are much more exciting than they used to be. And we continue to focus on higher quality bonds. And we do still own commodities. And we've talked a lot in the past about having a third asset class because it was a belief of ours that at some point you might see the stock and bond market move together because those two things have been tied at the hip from a valuation perspective. If you recall, we all talked about TINA, there is no alternative.
Right.
And kind of what the Fed was doing, backstopping risk. The Fed and QE wanted you to actually, they were taking treasuries off your balance sheet, pushing rates low so that you'd take risk. And now we're unwinding that. And so I still think those three asset classes in a 60-40 still belong. But we are a bit more excited on the equity side of the equation. But certainly bonds at this point are a better hedge, and there's still something that you should own.
Got to run. Hey, Brett, thank you. Have a good holiday. Brent Schuette over at Northwestern Mutual Wealth Management.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.